when we consider all of the themes of this debate, they really are the central themes that will underpin a national discussion about healthcare this year and into next year. If we go into next year with a kind of a solid understanding of where everybody stands, I think we'll all be better off.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is Susan Dentzer. Susan Dentzer is the editor-in-chief of Health Affairs, which, as most of you know, is the nation's leading journal on health policy. Before assuming that position, on May 1st, 2008, Susan Dentzer had served for the past 10 years as an on-air correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, where she led the unit that was dedicated to providing in-depth coverage of healthcare, health policy, and social security issues. And prior to joining the NewsHour in 1998, she was the chief economics correspondent and an economic columnist for U.S. News and World Report. Susan Dentzer is a graduate and very loyal alumna of Dartmouth College and now serves as a member of the Board of Overseers of the Dartmouth Medical School. She served on the Dartmouth College Board of Trustees from 1993 to 2004, and in fact was the first woman ever to serve as chair of Dartmouth's board, holding that position from 2001 to 2004. And she's also a former trustee of the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. Gosh, the list goes on. Susan Dentzer is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and very dear to her heart, as well as to many of us in this room, is on the board of directors of the International Rescue Committee. At the International Rescue Committee, Susan heads the board's health committee, which oversees the organization's healthcare programs in 25 countries around the world. Susan will be spending most of tomorrow with the local IRC leadership and visiting one of the clinics that serves IRC clients. When we started working on the healthcare debate about 6 months ago, several of us from the Miller Center spent several hours with Susan Dentzer. Her knowledge of the health issues, the economic implications, the people, and the politics of healthcare is perhaps the most extensive of any person we've ever encountered. It's a pleasure and a privilege to welcome Susan Dentzer.
Thank you very much, George, and good day to all of you. It's wonderful to be here with you at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia, and so appropriate to be here at the University of Virginia, given the obvious long-standing connection to Thomas Jefferson, one of the founding fathers, and a person who, if I imagine, could be here today with us, would engage quite vigorously in this discussion over whether there is indeed a right to health care. As George said, when we decided to do this debate and when Miller Center came to us at the NewsHour, where I then was, to propose this, we thought, how terrific, because how important, first of all, to have a high-level, intelligent forum on this issue at a time where healthcare is very much on the minds of the public, but very little of the public discussion, frankly, is often at a high level. Even in the presidential debates, one doesn't really spend much time really getting to the heart of the matter, which is really, to my mind, a question not just of rights, but it's a question about values. What are our values as a society? Where do we want to expend our resources? Where will we draw the line? What will we not allow people to dip down into in terms of any level of depravity, in terms of lack of access to health care? Also, though, entertaining the serious questions about allocating resources. Our resources as a country are not infinite. And we know that we could, if we wanted to let the healthcare system go unchecked, we probably could consume all the resources in the country on healthcare alone. So to have all of those questions on the table in a very important forum, such as the Miller Center afforded us, was obviously an unparalleled opportunity, and therefore we were very, very glad to partner with you in the discussion in April at Faneuil Hall in Boston. As you heard in the debate, or as those of you who have seen it, or let me tell you, those of you who have not, one very important line was said at one point, which I think encapsulated much of the discussion. And it really was a sentence that was uttered by former Congressman Dick Armey. He said at one point in the discussion, "America is about the liberty of the individual, not the well-being of the collective." And in making that statement, he was really hearkening back to a debate that is indeed as old as this country, which is, what is the meaning of the United States? Some of you may have read the book Founding Brothers by Joe Ellis, a wonderful account of the founding fathers, who of course were so young at the time and so close to one another in many respects that Ellis says we ought to call them the founding brothers, not the founding fathers. But as Ellis walks through the discussions that were had among various people in that group, Thomas Jefferson among them, this core question was very much at the root of what they were discussing as they were thinking through the foundation of the Republic. Initially, of course, the discussion was all about separating from England and shedding the yoke of tyranny and so forth and so on. But as they began to transition to thinking the same kinds of ideas that eventually found their way into the Constitution, it really was much more discussion about, well, having freed ourselves from the yoke of bondage to Mother England, now what will we become? And in the discussion in the Federalist Papers and in other modes of communication and discussion that the Founding Fathers had among themselves as much as with the public, is this underlying tension. Are we about the rights of the individual, or are we about creating a kind of a new Jerusalem, a area where a point in time, an aspect of humanity, where we really are going to be not, I wouldn't use the word collective, I think Armey used that rather deliberately because of course it has senator kind of socialistic implications, but are we really about the common good, the common weal? And as Ellis writes in Founding Brothers, most of us are drawn to aspects of both. Most of us would never, or few of us, I think, would say unilaterally we're one or the other. It's only about individual rights, and we don't care about the common good, and we're not trying to build a new Jerusalem here. Some of us, very few of us, would gravitate to that, and very few of us would say, well, it has nothing to do with individual rights, and it's all about the common good, because that does begin to creep closer to the collective. So most of us kind of bounce back and forth between these, and the nation indeed bounces back and forth between these. And when Armey uttered this sentence, I thought to myself as a moderator of the debate, hallelujah, because he's crystallized it. He is one who does apparently come down on the side, and as I say, he said, America is about the liberty of the individual, not about the common good. But as I say, I think most of us will say yes, but it's both. And we are constantly, as a nation, struggling between those two. When we get to the question of healthcare being a right, this tension, I think, comes up once again. Because we all recognize at one level that it is about not just the right of the individual to have health care, but we always gravitate to the notion that along with rights do go responsibilities. So we don't want to create for ourselves, I think, the notion of an unlimited right. You get, for example, unlimited health care no matter how poorly you take care of yourself, for example. So we, even though we might declare that there is a right to health care, we immediately in our minds start to put some constraints around that. On the other hand, 90% or so of the American public asked if there is a right to health care will say yes. And then when you ask them the secondary question, it's because people recognize that having access to health care really is a core portion of having a well society. And so it gets back to the idea of the common good, that comes home very strongly in what people think. And of course, as Judy Ann Bigby, the top health official in the state of Massachusetts, said in the debate in Massachusetts in April, she invoked the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which was signed, as you may know, in 1948, which states that everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself or herself and their families, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services. So we signed on to this as a nation, and it's delicately worded. It's a right to a standard of living that is adequate to include all of these things, including health. But basically, health is subsumed in this umbrella notion of this is what it takes to have a decent life, and one has a right to a decent life. So having signed on to this and the subsequent covenant that she also mentioned, that we also signed on to, Americans are still fundamentally, I think, asking themselves, well, if we do believe that there is a right to health care, and we did sign on to this, and 90% of Americans think there is a right to health care, there's 10% like Dick Armey that doesn't necessarily agree, but 90% do, then why are we where we are as a country today? Why are we in a situation where we thought enough about the importance of health care that we guaranteed access to that under Medicare for those 65 and older, and also for the disabled who qualify for Medicare? Notwithstanding what Dick Armey said in the debate, we don't force anybody into Medicare in this country, nor do we cut off providers if they sell their services privately to persons who agreed not to be enrolled in Medicare. We're still to this day not quite sure where he was coming from on that perspective. Nonetheless, we thought enough about the importance of health care to the elderly, and the frail elderly in particular, that we passed Medicare. And as many of you will know, when Medicare was passed in 1965, many of the backers of Medicare thought that this was a way station on the road to national health coverage. They thought it was the next wave of coverage and that we would finally get to the wave beyond that, which was everybody. Well, of course, as we know, that has not happened. We did, however, pass an additional program, Medicaid, which was designed initially to cover the poor. It does cover probably about half, 60% of the poor for various reasons, because it's a federal and state program, and different states can set different eligibility rules. It probably still manages to leave at least a third of the poor uncovered because they, for one reason or another, will fall through the cracks created in various states. But we thought at least enough of the principle that the poor should have access to health care that we tried to put a program on the table and pass a program into law that served that purpose, and Medicaid more or less has done that. But that still leaves, as we know, perhaps 47 million people in this country without health insurance at any given point in time for as long as a year. And in that 47 million number, frankly, because of the way that number comes from the Census Bureau, because of the way those numbers are collected, it's quite possible that number pulls in about 2 million undocumented immigrants, illegal immigrants. So we don't literally know that there are 47 million Americans without health insurance at any given point in time. There certainly are at least 47 million people here without health insurance, and probably 45 million of whom are, in fact, Americans, are, in fact, citizens. And, of course, as we know, those numbers have been growing, roughly speaking, on the order of about 1 million a year. So if we leave this process unchecked, we will be, within a matter of years, we'll be able to say that we have 50 million people in a country of just upwards of 300 million who do not have health care coverage. So that is why we're back to having this discussion about a right, because and the attendant question, which we discussed in the debate, which is not only is it a question of whether do Americans have a right to health care, is it the obligation of the government to secure that right? Does the government have an obligation to step in and make sure that systems are created that do give all Americans access to adequate health care? And that, again, is, I would say, the crux of the debate that we're having now as a nation and that we expect to have throughout this presidential election year and certainly in the months into next year as well. Because if the government has an obligation to secure that right, then theoretically the government has to go attack this problem of 50 million Americans, more or less, about to be without health care coverage and without assured access to health care coverage. It possibly also has to tackle an additional problem that there are certainly at least 15 million, by some estimates, 25 million Americans who do have health care coverage, but it is so inadequate that they expend extraordinary amounts of their income out of pocket on health care that is not covered by their health insurance. And as a consequence, they go into debt, they're hounded by collection agencies. They often declare bankruptcy, they default on those debts, et cetera, et cetera. And for all intents and purposes, they end up very much in the same pool as people who lack coverage altogether, because since they have an inadequate coverage, they do the same things that uninsured populations do. They don't go to the doctor for preventive care because they can't afford it. They delay seeking care as long as they possibly can because they can't afford it. So, the underinsured pool, as they're called, really have to be taken into connection along with the uninsured pool, and that gets us up to probably in the neighborhood of 75 million individuals. So the question becomes then, do those people really have a right to health care that is being denied them, and is it being denied to them in large part because the government has defaulted on its obligation to secure that right? And as I say, that I think is the crux of our political discussion today. As you heard, those of you who watched the debate and others of you who did not watch could certainly read this on the transcript. We had two individuals, Regina Hertzlinger and Judy Ann Bigby, who felt very strongly that there was a right and that the government did have a duty to secure that right. And Regina Hertzlinger in particular took pains to say that having the government secure that right does not mean the government provides health care itself. And so that those who are worried about, quote, socialized medicine, that is to say government-provided health care, and of course, right after that, when people say government-provided health care, they're also very quickly thinking about government-withheld health care because they're thinking about rationing. They're thinking about the United Kingdom. They're thinking about the National Health Service of the UK, which has explicitly set limits on what kind of health care will be provided and in what amount. Now, those limits are being tested, as people from the UK would be the first to tell you. And the UK, in effect, has decided it's not spending enough money on health care and that it has to raise the proportion of GDP that it does devote to health care. But nonetheless, if you want an example of socialized medicine, you'll look at the UK, and many Americans are afraid of that, and when we say the government should secure the right, they immediately think this means that the government must provide it. This will get to socialized medicine. This will lead to rationing. This will lead to long lines. People who are 65 years old won't be able to get dialysis treatment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As I say, Regina Hertzlinger and others will take pains to say this doesn't mean that the government has to provide health care. And in fact, in the United States, we have some but not a lot of provision, government provision of health care. We have the Veterans Administration, which does indeed provide health care to our veterans. We have the Defense Department, which does indeed provide a lot of health care to those in service, and it pays for a lot of health care for service people and their dependents through a program known as TRICARE. We have the Indian Health Service, which does indeed provide health care to Native Americans and Indian populations. So we do have some provision, government provision of health care, but we don't have a lot, and there probably isn't a whole lot of public support for having a massive government expansion into health care. What we're really talking about when we talk about the government securing the right, as Regina Hertzlinger said, is does the government have the responsibility to basically transfer funds to individuals who cannot otherwise obtain health coverage. And of course, she would be the first to say that when we're speaking about the government here, let's remember that at least from the standpoint of the Founding Fathers, the government is us, not them. The government is us. So basically, when we say the government has the responsibility to do this, what we're saying, in effect, in the view of Hertzlinger and others, is the government, it is our job through the government to transfer resources among ourselves to make sure that the poorest among us, the frailest among us, the elderly, most elderly among us, have adequate access to health coverage. And the rest of us will take care of ourselves with the resources that we retain. And under that kind of a rubric, what Regina Hertzlinger says and what Judy Ann Bigby very much agreed with is, we have this responsibility to do this through the government. One thing that we know the government does very well is tax us. We can experience that every April 15th, and we see that that's one of the most efficient things the government does, is collect money and transfer it. So that is the idea put on the table now, that what we need to do more of in this country is aggregate a little bit more of our collective resources, transfer those through the government to parties who are not currently capable of getting coverage themselves. However, Regina Hertzlinger and Judy Ann Bigby would go on to say government has additional responsibilities. It can't just do that. It does probably have some responsibility to make sure that there's an adequate design of a market, even if it's fundamentally a private market for health coverage that could be subsidized, say, through government funding. And that has given rise to ideas such as were being floated this year by the Democratic candidates and now obviously by the presumptive nominee, Senator Obama, to basically have government help organize a mechanism that would enable people to buy coverage. And one idea on the table is to do what is done, very, very comparable to what is done for the federal employees. Federal employees get a book every year of options, Blue Cross, Aetna, Kaiser, what have you. They can pick among an array of private health insurance plans, and then they contribute some money to that coverage, and the government kicks in some money as an employer, as their employer kicks in money on their behalf. A comparable idea is to create a kind of the same program for all Americans, where all Americans, in effect, would get a book and would pick through the plans. Do I want Blue Cross? Do I want Kaiser Permanente? Do I want Aetna, et cetera, et cetera? And be able to pick, and then if you were low income or elderly, you'd still get the government subsidy. That is to say, we as a people would transfer some money to you to help you buy that, and those who did not need any assistance could still buy that. In that kind of a construct, the coverage remains private. As we know, the healthcare delivery remains private, private hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, private providers, et cetera. But the government has taken a role in organizing the market by basically requiring this kind of pool to be created, and that's a very operative idea on the table. To switch over to the other side, the counterargument, you heard, of course, from Dick Armey, and in the debate he spoke about how this really the government should have no role in it, but even he seemed basically to acknowledge that there was a responsibility to provide to ensure that there be healthcare be delivered to the poor. Now, we didn't have time in the discussion to draw him out on that. Some have said that, yes, there is a responsibility to provide care for the poor, but that has to be done in a private, charitable context, no government role. We didn't get to the heart of the matter with Dick Armey and ask him, do you also agree that this has to be private, charitable contributions, not a government responsibility? I have to believe, as a member of Congress, if a debate had come up on the floor to vote to repeal Medicare, Medicaid, he would have voted against that, because I suspect, not just to save his political skin, but also because even with his concerns about individual liberties, I believe even he would recognize that we pretty much evolved to agreeing that there is a government role. That is to say, we have the role of transferring resources among ourselves via our government to those people, those poor, those frail, those elderly. There is Richard Epstein in the discussion also, frankly, came very, very close to agreeing that there was indeed a right to health care. He was supposed to argue the side that said there wasn't a right to health care. In his opening comments, those of you who saw the debate heard him say, I agree with a lot of what's been said on the other side. And indeed, as a person, as we all have, he's suffered his own raft of illnesses. He's seen illness in his family. He would be very hard-pressed to say we don't have a fundamental right to health care. His concerns really were more about how government has the ability, if it wades too much into private decisions and too much into the private market, to really muck things up. And that was the bulk of what he was saying through the course of the debate. And of course, that view has a lot of, there are a lot of people who share that view, I should say. And of course, we have some evidence that that's the case. The government has had spectacular incidences where it has waded into markets and mucked things up. And some people think, regardless of whether you think about the wisdom of Medicare, there are some features of the Medicare program, most specifically price setting. The government does, in effect, dictate what it's going to pay in Medicare for hospital services, for physician services, and so on. And some clearly that because Medicare is such a huge purchaser of healthcare services, clearly that has had a role in shaping the market, and some, many people think to an adverse degree. It's in effect government price setting, and of course most economists would rather see prices set in a freer market, freer market, as opposed to be dictated by a government entity. And then you get into forms of economic inefficiency from that. The closer you get to having the government be the biggest purchaser of any services, the more you get to what is known in economics as monopsony, and that can indeed distort markets. So Richard Epstein and people like that are really arguing that that's the danger. But as I say, the fundamental notion that there isn't some sort of right to health care, they're not willing to say that there's no right to health care. It's really more a question of what's the role of the government in this, in the provision of this, in the organization of the market, et cetera, et cetera. And Richard and many who agree with him are fearful that in a discussion about covering the uninsured, for example, that we might move into a situation where so much of the healthcare was being paid for by government, so much price setting was being done by government, that it would produce these distortions in the marketplace. And in effect, we would all be worse off because, of course, in a perfect world in economics, you have a functional marketplace that produces the best goods at the lowest possible price, and we're all better off. If that's distorted, we are all, in theory, worse off, and that is his major concern. Just to wind to the conclusion, I think I'm getting to the near the end of my my allotment here of time. When we step back from and consider all of the themes of this debate, they really are the central themes, I think, that will underpin a national discussion about healthcare that we are likely to have, as I say, this year and into next year. And if we go into next year with a kind of a solid understanding of where everybody stands, I think, not very dissimilar from the lines that were joined in this debate, I think we'll all be better off. Because, again, to step back, as I say, almost everybody agreed on some core points. Almost everybody agreed that healthcare is extremely important. It is a prerequisite of having a meaningful, full life. It is a prerequisite of having, of basically being able to achieve in society as much as anything else. And so we agree on that. There was broad agreement, again, on the notion that if you have this right to health care, that at least there is some government role for those who cannot access health care on their own, who do not have sufficient resources. So we agree on that. And that, to me, is very, very promising, because it means that when you go into a discussion, what do we do about the 47 million without health insurance? And what do we do about the additional 25 million, perhaps, who don't have adequate coverage? That's really where we need to focus our attention now. We agree that this needs to be done. How do we do it in a way that doesn't take us down the road of socialized medicine, which clearly many in the country are fearful of, doesn't create enormously distorted markets, which very many in the country are worried about, doesn't violate doesn't let us off the hook from having some individual responsibilities to take care of ourselves. And we know now that we're in an environment where Perhaps 80% of our healthcare costs are related to chronic diseases, and a good portion of our chronic diseases are due to lifestyle factors, not entirely, because most of these diseases are some mix of our genetic makeup and environmental exposures, whether it's to too much food, whether it's to too much sunlight, too much cigarette smoke, what have you. This interaction between genes and the environment is very real, and to the degree we can have some role in minimizing our exposure to things, we should have that responsibility. So how do we balance all this together, keep us responsible, functioning individuals, have access to healthcare, which we agree is a right, support those who cannot purchase it on their own, not distort the market too much, not have the worst of all possible outcomes, so-called welfare loss. How do we do all of that? That's really the key discussion. It's not going to be easy to solve that, and various proposals that have been put forward by the campaigns, whether Democratic or Republican, fall, in my opinion, far, far, far short of achieving the goals that everybody, I think, could agree on. But that's okay, because in presidential campaigns, that's not the venue to hash out details like this. The venues to hash those out are the halls of Congress, the state legislatures throughout the country. Those are the places where these kinds of decisions need to be made. And also, very importantly, in the town halls of America, because the American public and any reforms that are put in place are probably going to require some changes, whether it is higher taxes for some of us, whether it is, in fact, potentially some new ways of purchasing health insurance. As you may know, many proposals essentially would move us away from an environment where largely those of us who have private insurance are getting that through employers. We may have to indeed evolve to a system where we sever that link between employment and insurance. So in order for the public to be ready for the kinds of changes that may need to take place, the public has to be brought into this discussion. And that's why I'm so grateful to the Miller Center for having afforded this opportunity. To me today, to those who attended the seminar, the debate in Boston, and of course those who watched it over public television stations throughout the country. So thank you very much.
Susan, thank you. I will, in just a moment, move to the back of the room, and I would ask those who have questions that they would like to direct at Susan or put on the floor for discussion to queue up in the back of the room, and we will take as many questions as we have time for. Susan, I'd like to, if I can, just cut right to the chase. Presidential elections are more about differences than they are trying to find common ground. Each of the major political parties now has a presumptive nominee, and each is staked out positions on the issues that we've been discussing today. Could you please describe, as to each of the presumptive candidates, sort of where they're coming from, what their philosophical approach is to the Joe Ellis question that you outlined? Are we a commonwealth, or are we sort of free to go our own way and not worry so much about the less fortunate? What are the elements of their respective healthcare programs? You talked a little bit about the Obama approach, but if you could perhaps flesh out where that differs from the McCain approach. And then if you could talk about how you, as a very well-informed observer of the debate, what you see as the strengths and weaknesses of each of the two programs. And finally, could you perhaps wrap up this question by suggesting where you see the areas where there could be some compromise?
Great. As I said earlier, and it's I think worth repeating, in my experience, health reform proposals put forward in the context of an election campaign are truly half-baked. And they're half-baked for various reasons. Often they're half-baked because to get into a lot of detail, you begin to talk about things that will make somebody mad. You begin to talk about income redistribution. You begin to talk about taxation, et cetera, et cetera. So both of, in the case of Senator Obama and in the case of Senator McCain, both of those proposals I would describe at the moment as half-baked or half-evident, maybe even less than half-evident. But in general, here I think is how it's fair to describe them. Senator Obama has said that he supports universal coverage. Universal coverage in his context, again, does not mean government-provided health care. It doesn't necessarily mean completely government-financed health care. It means, rather, a system in which everybody has health insurance, whether it's public, whether it's private. He has said that he is in favor of that. He has not put forward a proposal at this point that would actually deliver that. Because he has not proposed, for example, an individual mandate to have health insurance, as has been put in place now in Massachusetts. Massachusetts in 2006 undertook a series of health reforms. It had, relatively speaking, a low rate of uninsured in that state relative to other states. Best estimates are that it had about 600,000 uninsured individuals. About half of them have now been picked up in the 2 years since those reforms were implemented, and probably 90% eventually will be picked up. And one of the key ways, the Massachusetts reforms had multiple pieces to it, but one key piece was an individual mandate, a requirement that individuals have health insurance. That was then coupled with a determination of what was affordable for individuals, because you can't make people, if people can't afford a Cadillac, you can't make people buy a Cadillac. So a determination was made about how much of your income should go to health coverage. And certain people, frankly, were let out of the program, let out of the responsibility, because their incomes were such that health insurance was just prohibitive. But by and large, most people in Massachusetts at the end of the Massachusetts reforms will have coverage, and a key piece of that will have been the individual mandate. Obama hasn't proposed that, and those of you who followed the primary battles know that he and Senator Clinton exchanged many, many words about this, with Senator Clinton arguing that because she did have an individual mandate, she would get to universal coverage. Because Senator Obama didn't have one, he would not. Now, to be fair, Senator Obama has said he would rather repair the system first, see what happens, and then if at the end an individual mandate were needed to provide coverage, he would agree to help enact one. So we shall see. In essence, what Senator Obama is talking about, it appears, is some combination of creating those purchasing pools that I talked about earlier, where there would be abilities for Americans to access insurance through group insurance coverage. As many of you will know now, the best deal you can get on health insurance is if you're buying it in a group. If you're a group of employers, if you're buying it through AARP, et cetera, et cetera. The worst way to buy health insurance is on the individual insurance market, because first of all, you are going to be medically underwritten. The insurer is going to come in and look at every aspect of your health care and your health history and decide whether you're worth taking a risk on. They're going to assume that you're probably going to be worse off than you say you're going to be, and so they're going to factor in an additional price for that. And then plus, because they've had to go to all this effort, there's going to be an additional administrative expense in the price of the policy just by virtue of the fact that they've had to do this medical underwriting on you. So that's the worst way to buy health insurance, and it's the most costly way. And today, people who go out on the individual insurance market find that they either have very bad options for coverage, very expensive options for coverage, or they can get coverage that has so-called pre-existing condition restrictions and writes out of their coverage anything that they currently suffer from. A classic, and even things that they're not suffering from. The New York Times had a story a couple weeks ago about a woman who tried to buy coverage through a company called Golden Rule Insurance. They wouldn't sell it to her because they said she had had a cesarean section 20 years earlier, and theoretically in the future this could lead to problems. So they denied her coverage on the basis of that. So it's a tough battle to get insurance through the individual market. You want to get away from that. You want to create group coverage. And basically, the whole principle of group coverage is that the well people subsidize the sick people. You spread the costs across the large group. And so we all end up paying an average price. I, as a healthy person, pay more. The sick person, therefore, doesn't pay stratospheric rates but manages to get coverage. So this notion of creating big purchasing pools and putting everybody in America into a series of these pools and letting them buy coverage is very much the way Senator Obama is going. He is making one additional assertion, which is that the main bar to people buying coverage right now is the cost, he says, and indeed it is true that health insurance is increasingly unaffordable. The average family policy now costs about $13,000 a year, and health insurance premiums have gone up 90% since the year 2000. Even the wages have only gone up about 24%. So he says the unaffordability of insurance is the main problem, and he has a proposal to deal with that, which I won't go into because it's extraordinarily tedious to explain, but it's a so-called reinsurance proposal where, in essence, he would have the government pick up the costs of health care for anybody whose health care costs in a given year exceeded $50,000. He hasn't priced out that proposal. Many people think it would cost a whole lot more than he has said that it would. This is what I mean about the plan being half-baked, because it's predicated on some things that he essentially has not provided a lot of detail on. It's not even clear if they would work, and it's certainly not clear what they would cost. So a half-baked proposal, the premises of which are move toward universal coverage, try to lower the cost of health care. Senator McCain has not used the word universal coverage, but he speaks as if he does truly believe, and the phrase he has used is all Americans should have access to health insurance. Now, some speechwriter clearly thinks that there's some difference between giving Americans access to health insurance and giving Americans insurance. I'm not sure what it is, but that, at least in terms of the rhetoric, that's how he is describing it. What Senator McCain would do is take something known as the tax exclusion of health insurance and use it differently. What is the tax exclusion of health insurance? Many of you may know that if you receive a health insurance benefit through your employer, that is deductible to the employer. The money that the employer spends on your health insurance and your health care is deductible to the employer just the way salaries are, and it's non-taxable to the individual. So we get health insurance benefits that are, as I say, the value of the premium value of the policy is $13,000, $15,000, whatever. We pay no tax on that at the federal level and at the state level, because states typically follow the federal taxation formula. So we don't pay any tax on that. And the value of that so-called tax exclusion is getting close to $200 billion a year. What does that tax exclusion do? And in fact, it works as a subsidy for people who have coverage. So it's a subsidy to people who have the thing that we want to subsidize. And for years, economists have said this makes no sense. We should take the value of that subsidy and spread it around and help everybody get coverage, not just people who are lucky enough or smart enough to work for an employer who provides the coverage. So essentially what Senator McCain would do is make health insurance contributions from your employer taxable to you. That would produce about $200 billion a year in revenue. He would take that amount and feed it back to all of us in the form of a tax credit, which we would then be enabled to use to buy our own health insurance coverage. The amount of that tax credit would be about $5,000 per family, and $2,500 for an individual, $5,000 for a family. Now, you'll recall that I just said that in health insurance coverage, the average price is $13,000 for a family. So what Senator McCain is talking about is giving us a $5,000 tax credit for something that we still have to come up with $8,000 more to buy, more or less. And when this is pointed out to Senator McCain, he says, yes, I know. I would have liked to have made the tax credit bigger, but it's just too expensive. And that just tells you that this $200 billion will only get you so far. If you don't put more money into that the program that he's describing, you won't have tax credits that are big enough to support it. So that's the degree to which his program is, I would say, half-baked. Another aspect of it is, as many have pointed out to Senator McCain is a cancer survivor, as you know, and Elizabeth Edwards, the wife of a former presidential candidate, John Edwards, who also suffers from cancer, actually threw out a question at one point to McCain and said, what would you do for people in this country who have pre-existing health conditions? Because nothing that you have described is going to address the problem of people who are very sick, who have big medical care costs, who could not afford to buy coverage in the current system, and for whom a $5,000 tax credit is going to be even of less value because they would probably be trying to purchase a policy that if anybody would sell it to them in the first place would cost $25,000 or so a year. So what are you going to do for those people? And Senator McCain initially didn't have a response to that. His campaign then came back and said, well, here's what we would do. We would create so-called high-risk pools around the country. And in fact, there are already a number of these high-risk pools where specific public programs that are set up for people like this to come in and get coverage through a public program. These are typically now done at the state level. And Senator McCain said, what I would do is I would go to all the governors and I'd say, here's some model legislation, set up these high-risk pools. And that's how we'll take care of these people. Small problem. A lot of these pools already exist. They often close because it's so costly to provide coverage this way. Florida's high-risk pool has been closed to new entrants since 1994. They have not let anybody into the pool since 1994. So these programs also are unaffordable, probably without large-scale federal subsidies. Senator McCain has not said he would have any of those subsidies forthcoming. He says, I'll go talk to the governors. So that's a degree to which his program is also half-baked. So stepping back from it, what do we have here? We have two candidates who say this is a serious problem, who want to address it, who want more Americans to have health coverage, who have different approaches. In a certain sense, Senator McCain's is even more radical than Senator Obama's because of this recycling of the tax exclusion. That's a bigger policy step, frankly, than anything Obama's talking about. And they don't really, they haven't spoken fully about what the costs of these are, what the trade-offs are, whether these would even work, et cetera, et cetera. So I think what they've managed to do, though, is they have certainly joined the debate. Each of them, I'm quite confident, has learned a whole lot more about these issues in the course of this campaign. Either of them will be a better president because of it, regardless of who is elected, because they will have waded into this and realized that this is harder than it looks. It's extremely important, but it's going to be a very, very serious proposition, and it's probably going to have them signing on in the end to things that they didn't necessarily think they would sign on to, whether it's a mandate on Obama's side, whether it's something other than high-risk pools on McCain's side. Clearly, the positions for both of them would evolve greatly if they ended up at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
I would like to ask you to explore a little bit deeper this incendiary word rationing, which was mentioned only once during the debate, and you brought it up again. But it seems to me that it is implicit that some type of rationing must be done. Now, some years ago in Oregon, they set up a program to look at Medicaid, what they would cover under Medicaid. I think Governor Kitzhaber was the one that set this up. And it seemed like a very eminently sensible way to approach it, to have town meetings and to have a broad-based consensus develop. But I understand that it really never worked very well. Can you elaborate a little bit on what happened in that system and why it didn't work?
Oregon's overall health reform, of which that was a piece, did eventually come apart because of basically funding reasons. But the rationing piece of it, or at least the attempt to prioritize, is probably a better way to say it, what would be paid for, particularly under the Medicaid program in Oregon, also had a very interesting set of outcomes. It turns out that when you sit down and look at a lot of healthcare procedures that are provided, sometimes in the abstract, it's easy to say, I'm not going to pay for them. But when people really sit down and think about it, they decide to pay for them. And one classic example in the case of Oregon was initially a proposal was on the table that no organ transplants would be paid for under Medicaid. Well, try looking a mom in the face and telling her that her 9-year-old child can't have a kidney transplant simply because she's on Medicaid, whereas the kid next door can because his dad makes $10,000 a year more. Oregonians wouldn't do that. So when they came up with their list of what they would pay for, it ended up being longer than they thought and costing more money than they had planned. Because when they really sat down and began to ask these questions, what do we have a right to health care? Can I look a poor mom in the face and say her kid must die? They said no to that, and they ended up paying for more than they thought. So it was everybody, I think, to this day agrees it was a very useful exercise. It did not have the result of having them spend less. Quite the opposite. It had them agree to spend more. And the things that they eventually agreed not to pay for were very obvious sort of no-brainers. Payment for care treatment provided for the common cold. Well, guess what? There is no treatment for the common cold, right? So the things that were crossed off the list ended up in the end being things that we agree are not medical interventions of value anyway. That doesn't mean that we don't have to address a rationing question down the line. And there are many, many views on that. I guess I would make a couple of points. One is we're already rationing care anyway. We do it by not having people have health insurance. That's clearly a way we're saving the country a bunch of money right now because 47 million people are getting less health care than they would otherwise. So we are rationing. We're just doing it through the back door. Many people who've studied healthcare closely think that a huge problem that we have in the U.S. healthcare is that we're purchasing a lot of healthcare that has no value or minimal value. We're certainly paying a whole lot for it. In fact, our price level, about a third of U.S. of the difference between U.S. healthcare expenditures and other nations' healthcare expenditures is simply in the form of higher prices. We pay higher hospital prices, we pay more for our drugs, we pay our physicians more, et cetera, et cetera. So that's on the table for examination. And a lot of people think that if we just got rid of the inappropriate care we're providing and used those dollars instead on appropriate care, we probably really wouldn't necessarily need to ration because we're spending $2 trillion plus, let's say a third of it is wasted. What if we could recover the third that is wasted? Maybe we don't really have to do much rationing in the sense of denying people access to very sophisticated interventions. And then a final issue on the table is we do spend a great deal of money in the last stages of life. And analyses that have been done of that spending show that we have just crazy variations around the country about how much gets spent on people who are very sick in the last months of life. And we probably could do a whole lot more to rationalize that. And it's very clear from some data that has been put together by researchers at Dartmouth who've analyzed Medicare data. It's pretty clear that a lot of what we're doing in the last 6 months of life is giving people excess care that, if anything, kills them faster. And so if we just sort of figured out a way to get a handle on that, we could probably give people very appropriate care at the end of life that would not be anywhere near as costly as what the care is that we provide now and possibly wouldn't be as dangerous, frankly, as some of the care we provide now.
So much of the discussion we heard in the debate regarded the role of government. Could government organize an efficient program or would it fail? And the references were to the situation abroad, Switzerland. I wonder if we can bring this back home and think of one example you mentioned, the Veterans Administration. Can we say that that system works effectively, keeps costs down, produces healthy results, and are the people receiving the care satisfied with what they receive?
The VA, as many of you will know, has made a stunning comeback over the course of the last 15 years, and now, indeed, provides some of the more effective care provided in America. It's done that for a number of reasons. It is the largest system in the country to have adopted an electronic health record, so it now has a very clear computerized patient record of what's done to patients. It's pioneered an enormous number of important safety initiatives, so the rate of medical errors in VA facilities is probably lower than it is in the general civilian population. It has undertaken a lot of other ancillary quality improvements. It's not perfect, and all you have to do is go out and talk to veterans, and they'll tell you that it's not perfect. There's still, obviously, it can be a very bureaucratic experience for many people. The government has drawn the line on who among the veteran population can obtain care through the VA system because the expense is so enormous. And many will argue, nonetheless, the VA to this day is underfunded. But it's hard to look at it and say the flaws of the VA are inherent in the government provision of health care. They're mainly inherent in the underfunding, by and large, of the VA. And I think, by my personal experience, and actually you can cite the fact, about 50% of medical residents in this country are trained through VA systems. So almost a great number of doctors in the country eventually will, in the course of their education, rotate through the VA. And an increasing piece of feedback that the VA hears from them is that the residents would prefer to practice at VA facilities because there are these emphases on quality and safety, and because there are electronic health records and the kinds of things that enable them to practice medicine better. And they would prefer to be in the VA versus the civilian system. And hopefully, the civilian world will eventually catch up so that we have the same features in the system that redound to the benefit of the patients in VA.
Closing question.
Hi, Susan. Marcus Martin, Emergency Medicine.
Great to see you.
Thank you so much for your comments. What I heard earlier about the individual rights to socialized medicine sounds pretty good. And of course, with civil liberties and individual rights, we tend to find individuals who abuse those and legislators who are reluctant to pass laws that would protect people, such as seatbelt laws and motorcycle riding laws, such as helmets, et cetera. And those individual rights are protected, and those individuals end up in our emergency departments and our hospitals with major injuries and a lot of expense related to trauma care, et cetera. So on one hand, the individual rights is a good thing. On another hand, it hurts all of us. In another example would be smoking, as you mentioned. Smoking in public places, that hurts the individual, but other people who are in public places as well. So that's just a comment. And this is perhaps a question for you related to other areas that the government already mandates, such as EMTALA. And for the folks here, EMTALA is Emergency Medicine Treatment and Active Labor Act, which came out of California in the mid-80s, which guaranteed access to care in the emergency setting for everyone who presents to a hospital that has Medicare subsidies. And so of 300 million plus people, one in three Americans utilize emergency departments anyway. So that's a guaranteed health care for those individuals, but it doesn't stop there. Those folks who have to be admitted, get admitted, and they get the care. The issue relates to preventative care and then follow-up for those folks. And as you said, those people at the last stages of life, quite a few of those never really got good care to begin with, and they may present to the emergency department once in a while. So it's a matter of shifting those resources and making sure that they get the appropriate care. So we're already doing certain things related to government mandates. And another example is DSH, disproportionate share of hospital funds that go to teaching hospitals to support patient care of indigent patients. And that typically goes to hospitals like the University of Virginia Hospital and Medical College of Virginia, but not to community hospitals. So we need to look at that fund. And certainly we'll probably have to put more money in funds like that to take care of everybody. So your thoughts about those comments? I know there were long comments, but again, those are comments related to things that are already in place that put us a little closer to universal health care to begin with.
Yes, and very much so, as you said, in the case of requiring institutions to provide emergency care. As you said, that leaves people exposed before they get to the state of emergency. And so one piece of an overall health reform clearly has to be shoring up primary care. Primary care is in a lot of trouble, primary care being basically your everyday doctor's visits is a way to think about it, or care for minimal levels of illness that you would get from your family doctor. Primary care practice is reimbursed rather poorly relative to many other forms of medical care. As a consequence, most of today's medical school graduates want to go and be medical specialists. Nobody wants to go into primary care. We have a real problem, and particularly if we're going to get a handle on chronic illness, we probably as a country need to really rethink the way we work with individuals to stay healthy through the course of their lives. There's a lot of discussion now about the so-called medical home, that everybody needs a medical home. What is a medical home? It's an idealized concept at this point, but it would be a place where you had a direct relationship with a primary care provider who was focused as much on helping you stay healthy as treating you when you came in sick, who would sit with you and say, what's your diet? Are you getting enough exercise? Do you have all the immunizations you need? Have you had the requisite screenings? Basically positions you to be as healthy in life as possible, and then also takes care of you with low levels of illness. We clearly need, there should surely be some kind of a mandate to primary care in America that's commensurate with the mandate to emergency care. How are we going to get there? We'll probably only get there through the back door, which is this mandate to coverage. But I think it makes an important point that even if we just deal with coverage, we still have a lot of work to do on the delivery system in the U.S. The whole delivery of healthcare has to be pretty much completely rethought. And we have a lot of wonderful tools that will enable us to do it. I was with a UVA group down in Wise County, Virginia, at a fair of a health fair that where people were getting health care for free. But one feature of the free care was they were being seen by somebody at University of Virginia Medical Center by telemedicine and having a teleconsultation, a dermatological consultation. At 100 plus miles distance, whatever the distance is. 300, okay. So those are the kinds of things that we now have the ability to take advantage of in this country. We just got to devise the systems that enable that to happen. You bring up an extremely important point, which is, as a lot of people say, it's the delivery system stupid. It's not just the financing of healthcare that needs to be thought through and rethought.
Susan Dentzer has the great gift of the ability to take these very complicated and seemingly intractable issues and making them much simpler for the rest of us to understand. Thank you very much for enhancing our understanding of the healthcare issues. Thank you.